It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. Joining us this afternoon, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. This, I understand, is going to be a continuation of a previous conversation we had with Cecil on the topic of the marriage contract. And I know that Wes is going to be participating in this with the issue of the how it's adjudicated and things of that nature. But Cecil, if you will, let's start with a quick background of what the significance of the marriage contract, the marriage license. That was something that was pretty stunning from my perspective.
Okay, Lockwood. Well, it is interesting, and I think it's something that a lot of our listeners just don't think about or ponder, but the significance of getting of a legal marriage in the state of North Carolina is quite a significant event. Absent a prenuptial agreement or an agreement between the parties to alter the contract of marriage, the parties have, for instance, a statutory right to many times become the administrator in a state, to become the guardian if there were an incompetency, to have an interest in the estate. For instance, we know that spouses have to sign deeds and join in the deeds when the deeds are out conveyances to people and folks sell property. The signature of the spouse is needed. So there are just a number of tax consequences. That's one I should throw in there real quickly, a tremendous tax consequences, distinctions between what can occur between just friends or neighbors or business partners versus, or even children, mm-hmm. versus the transfers that you can make to a spouse. But with all that said, Lockwood, the bottom line is that, yes, one of the most significant rights, if you will, of a spouse is the right to have an elective share in the estate of their respective husband or wife. So the bottom line is that in the state of North Carolina, Wes and I see clients every day. And of course, many times they will be in second or third marriages and they will make the comment, well, we have agreed between the two. I've actually have this filed this morning. Good folks coming in. We are in a second marriage and we are providing for our children from our prior marriage. And our spouses do not need our inheritance. And so we really don't need to leave anything to each other. So then at that point, we have to explain, well, we hear your intention, but the bottom line in the state of North Carolina is that after, depending on the number of years of marriage, there is an elective share or a statutory right in the estate of your spouse. And this is known in North Carolina as the elective share. Now, Lockwood, I have here in front of me the percentages and the number of years, but I don't want to take up too much time on that. I mean, it can get significant, you know, 15%, 25%, 33%, and 50% after 15 years of marriage. So, you can imagine that many folks don't know about this statute, and we are dancing around it all the time in our planning angle at our law firm. And Wes is, of course, buried in several comprehensive litigation files relative to the elective share. And it comes at Wes from any number of directions. It can come as petitioner, filing for the elective share, or it can come as defending the estate, if you will, or the other party relative to a claim for elective share. Wes, let's start with where does this petition for elective share get filed? In what court?
Well, it's going to be filed in the state court. It's going to be filed with the clerk of court, and it will be filed where the estate is pending. So once someone has passed away, a spouse has passed away, the surviving spouse or their agent through a power of attorney giving the authority to that agent or potentially a guardian could file for elective share, and they have to do that within 6 months of qualification of the administrator of the estate of the person who passed away.
Okay, so I'm to understand that there's a time frame, 6 months. You have a schedule in which to apply for the elective share. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Wow.
If you do not file that within in a timely manner, then it is waived, just like any other statute of limitations. It's just a very short statute of limitations.
Normally,
our statute of limitations in North Carolina, depending on the claim, is going to be a 3-year. If it's a breach of contract and negligence, your typical cases like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in fraud-related cases, it's 4 years. Sometimes it's 10 years under constructive fraud or products cases. So depending on the circumstances and the type of claim that you have the right to bring under the facts.
Okay.
Have a statute of limitations. Elective share, very short, 6 months.
If the individual fails to file within, the surviving spouse fails to file within 6 months for elective shares, then in essence, the will takes automatic control of the estate. What then fills in the situation following that six month window?
Well, the will or the intestate succession laws, if there's not a will, will control as it relates to how the estate passes anyway. But in the event that you have an elective share claim, it could be that the surviving spouse receives more than, let's say, the will leaves him or her.
Oh.
Okay? But in the event you do not file your elective share or don't file it in a timely manner, then the estate just passes without including the elective share calculation. So it just would be your standard distribution pursuant to the terms of the will or standard distribution pursuant to the intestacy laws in the state. We're talking about North Carolina, but wherever the estate is being administered.
All right. The marriage took place in Utah. The family moves to North Carolina. What time frame does the North Carolina take control of the marriage? And I just use Utah as a random state, but every state's a little different, I'm assuming, and particularly in the issue of the timing of elective shares, and is the concept of elective share a common understanding in the legal process? That would be the first question.
Well, right. You asked a couple of questions there.
Yep.
And the first one is a really good one, and we get that a lot. Lockwood, an estate is going to be handled in the county, if you will, and the state where the person had residency.
Okay.
And so where does one vote? Where is your driver's license? Where do you file your state tax return? Where's your home? Now, none of these factors, those are all factors of residency, and another big factor is your intention.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those factors are ironclad. It is a combination of looking at the totality of the circumstances, if you will, as to residency. But once the residency has been established or has been asserted, if you will, there is then the filing of the estate in that state. So if it were Idaho, then the Idaho law, or Utah rather,
okay,
said,
well,
Utah, the Utah law then would apply to that estate because, after all, that's where the residency of that estate is occurring. If, on the other hand, the folks have moved to North Carolina, as you say, and established residency here, then North Carolina will take control of the estate and will follow its law, and the elective share law would apply to the estate here in North Carolina.
Okay. All right. Those answers those two questions immediately.
And Lockwood, that is, that's an issue we deal with every day, I might add. I mean, that's not a,
yeah.
That's not, you know, I mean, many times it's like, well, did they still have their residency in North Carolina? Were they, you know, just because they moved and transferred to live with their daughter for, you know, the last year of their life in, you know, New Jersey, did they abandon their North Carolina residency?
Uh-huh.
Is the residency still here in North Carolina, or is it up in New Jersey? And so, you know, we do deal with this residency issue.
I can see a very complicated circumstance where obviously folks have moved. The children have, enticed the parents to move to their home, nearby their home in New Jersey or New York. And shortly thereafter, one of the spouses die. And so I can imagine the conflict of proving or intent and decision. I'm going to throw a real curve at this one here. Cecil and Wes, again, just to remind you, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal. But let's take, for example, a situation where the adult parents move to, let's pick on New Jersey for a moment, and the husband is disinclined to want to move, but he does so willingly with his wife or spouse, and then he dies shortly thereafter arriving. Then the estate, that's a big issue. I'm sitting here imagining this. I'm sure it's probably happened, has it not?
Yes, that happens. And again, we have to look at all of the circumstances.
Wow.
Lockwood, you know, did they buy a home in New Jersey, albeit they only were there for, you know, a couple of months?
Right.
But some people will buy a home or townhome just before they move directly into it. Did they vote? Did they establish a driver's license? What did they change the titles to their car, their license plates? I mean, all of these thing can change the circumstances. But more than anything else, and I keep going back to this, is intention.
Uh-huh.
What was the intention of the parties? I have a client who is moving to be with her daughter because they are older, and she's called to tell me that she does not want to update her documents in her daughter's state, that she's going to maintain her North Carolina residence.
Okay.
She's making it loud and clear, and she wanted me to mark that in the file that her trust and her documents are all going to be handled here in North Carolina. She's going to continue to own her beach house here.
Right.
But yes, she's 85 years old. She's going to go live with her daughter, you know, in Tennessee, but when I die, I want my estate handled in North Carolina. And I advised her, I said, well, let's don't change your driver's license, and let's don't register to vote. Let's vote by absentee ballot, still in North Carolina. Let's maintain our North Carolina Department of Revenue tax return. And these are the kinds of things that you would need to do. But loud and clear from her, a very important and very, very, pivotal fact is that it's just her intention to maintain her North Carolina residency.
That's an interesting twist to that earlier question with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. All right. We've talked about this issue of, issue of elective shares. And of course, with the multitude of marriages, split marriages and mixed marriages, we'll use that term. We've got children from one marriage, now with children from another marriage, same father, same mother, things of this nature. If there is a dispute, where does that dispute go relative to elective shares? You said that it's filed with the state of North Carolina, but I'm assuming there have been some issues where there have been disputes over the elective shares.
Absolutely, Lockwood. It's considered contested estate litigation.
Okay.
Okay, so it's interesting. In the event that you have an uncontested estate matter, then the clerk of court can hear that and decide that without a hearing, such as, in many cases, calculation of commission, simple issues like extensions of time on filing, things like that. Sometimes those matters become contested, and there's a necessity for a hearing. But when you have a an elective share claim, that is considered a contested estate matter because obviously we have many times legal issues involved with regard to how to calculate the total net assets, which is the total from which the percentage for the elective share is applied.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the calculation can be complicated. Sometimes there's issues with regard to whether assets are included or not. I have a case in particular where there's a promissory note in question with some unusual language, and currently dealing with the case, and it's a seven-figure difference between
wow.
whether it's included or not. So those are issues with the clerk of court.
Uh-huh.
When you file the elective share, you have to file with it a state action summons. In the event you don't do that, this is just kind of getting technical here, but in the event you don't do that, you just file a document with the clerk of court purporting to claim an elective share, then you have not properly filed it as an estate contested estate action, and therefore, if you don't do that within the 6 months, then you're subject to being dismissed,
mm-hmm.
And you don't have the elective share because that's the summons is what the court issues in order to receive personal and subject matter jurisdiction over the parties and the subject matter. So there's some details involved there in order to bring it in the right place. But to answer your question, is you bring this and you have to bring it properly. You have to get the summons issued. You have to get service. You have to do all the things that we're required to do to exercise due process under the Constitution and the statutes that ensure that
mm-hmm.
Before the clerk of court where the estate is pending. Now, sometimes we're in situations, I have a case like this right now, where the surviving spouse that I represent was not really in a position to be able to file an elective share because the children from the previous marriage of the deceased just wouldn't open the estate.
Wait a second. I'm missing something. So the children don't... I thought the estate would automatically be opened with the death
There's a process. This individual had a will
uh-huh.
named one of his children as the executor in the will, so typically it would be the incumbent upon the executor to appear at the respective clerk of court with the death certificate and the appropriate documentation, or to receive that documentation from the clerk of court to have the estate open, to have what's called letters testamentary issued. So
right.
that person would be qualified to handle the administration of the estate. Well, I believe they knew that my client had the right to the elective share and also a year's allowance, which has to be filed within 1 year of the estate being opened. And so the client, the surviving child, knew that there were some things, probably didn't know exactly what things could be done, but knew that some things could be filed by the surviving spouse. So the choice was to just keep the surviving spouse from being able to do that by simply not opening the estate. Well, the statutes of North Carolina deal with that. In the event that this named executor does not come forward and open the estate after a period of time and after a demand, then the spouse could have come forward and qualified
uh-huh.
as administrator of the estate. And that is the time period for which the 6 months runs for filing the elective share. So you can't keep someone from filing their elective share by not opening an estate. There's a process by which you go through to do that.
Of course, the other aspect of that is there are other members of the estate which also are being, if you will, challenged because there may be benefits to them that could accrue quickly, but they're delayed in getting that. That's an interesting series of challenges that you go through, Wes, in just trying to get an estate settled. The one thing I do have to ask, though, in this particular case, and I want to bring this up, we have situations where individuals decide they've been through maybe multiple marriages, and they then gain a partner. and they, rather than be involved in another marriage, they live with this partner. I'm going to use the term common law wife or common law marriage, but a common law marriage. And I'm wondering, what is the role of something of that nature where there has been this long-term relationship without that marriage contract? Is there such a thing as a common law marriage or a common law arrangement in North Carolina?
And the answer to that question is no, there is not.
Wow.
And North Carolina will not recognize that situation from another state either. States that may recognize a common law marriage, if we're dealing with the estate in North Carolina, and that, let's say, South Carolina recognizes common law marriages, if there's not a marriage certificate, then there's not going to be an actionable right to bring an elective share claim because there was no marriage that this state will recognize.
That is an interesting comment and concept. Because,
but Lockwood, yeah. I mean, the other side of the coin to that is that, we have a lot of clients in those situations, mm-hmm. long-term relationships, and, their property, they can own their home together,
right.
joint with right of survivorship. They can name each other on their accounts as beneficiary or establish the account again
uh-huh.
with survivorship. They can make out a last will and testament. Wes and I are opening an estate today, in fact, where a gentleman had a very long-term relationship with a woman and left his home in a trust for her for the remainder of her life.
Uh-huh.
So you can make out, as I'm saying, you can make out a last will and testament and protect your significant other that you've been with for years and all of those kinds of things. But if you're going to expect North Carolina just to recognize some right just because you've been in this relationship, living together, et cetera, then that's not going to be enough. Now, Wes has had a couple of litigation cases where the significant other person made an improvement to the real property,
uh-huh.
for instance.
Right.
The gentleman owned the house, but his girlfriend of 25 years,
mm-hmm.
Paid all of the taxes on the property, the insurance. They split everything 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
She added on the downstairs bedroom and spent $100,000. Those kinds of issues can sometimes, if you will, brew a case for Wes to analyze. Right, Wes?
Right. That's not the perfect situation, but yes,
no.
An unjust enrichment type claim.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
So because there's not a contract there, where there was an agreement that we could prove relative to the improvements, but there's unquestionably improvement to this, so to speak, boyfriend's, but so to speak, property.
Uh-huh.
And then if they're not together anymore, then or the person's died, then potentially having a claim for unjust enrichment is something that
we can sometimes
bring.
And that's called unjust enrichment?
Yeah, normally it's a substitute for a contract claim when there's not a contract. We call it a quasi-contract claim or an implied contract claim.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a contract dealing with the issue, but the law, basically it's an equitable type remedy where the law would recognize that it's not going to allow this other party to benefit under the circumstances for, under this case, the improvements that were made, because that would be unjust under the law.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying for purposes of those listening to go out and do that, and we'll protect you. No, that's not the way to do that.
Right.
In the event that those circumstances have transpired, because, when people do things like this, they don't anticipate that their significant other, their boyfriend, girlfriend, is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think that they're going to turn against them and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't love you anymore.
Right.
Thanks for the $150,000 you put into my house. They don't anticipate those things. The twists and turns of life all of a sudden, change the circumstance under which this person unjustly enriched the
mm-hmm.
other person.
Right.
So So protect yourself with regard to those things with a contract, or don't improve property that you don't own, those type of things.
We're talking...
And Lockwood, these cases, we've talked a lot about older folks. We have a lot of young folks, you know, really young, 20s and 30s, who, you know, are in relationships and they just don't want to get married, okay? Mm-hmm. And yet they buy a house together, or one of them is improving property on a lot that some, you know, and commingling all back and forth and all over everywhere. And then, of course, all of a sudden there's a breakup or whatever. Right. So be careful. You know, these relationships, you know, carry legal consequences.
As you pointed out, Cecil and Wes Collins with us, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins here on Let's Talk Legal. You know, we've talked about this numerous times about the fact that a little professional advice can be a great savings in both finances, time, and I'll throw in the third item, emotion. If you will just seek good advice at the outset, and I'm going to suggest very quickly, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins at Harvell and Collins, a local number, by the way, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, a little advanced discussion of planning and, as we're hearing now, contractual arrangements. And Cecil, our earlier conversations, Wes, your comments about the issue of the elective shares, 6 months window to apply for that elective share. Again, I just want to advise folks, this is not something that we do just here on the radio program, but also the value of going to visit with the folks at Harvell and Collins. And with that, Cecil, Wes, thanks for your time this afternoon.